Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to another Critical Action podcast. Today I'm joined by Henry Hill, Deputy Editor of Conservative Home, and Fred de Fassade, Director of Parliamentary Affairs for the Legatum Institute. And most importantly, they're both regular Critic contributors. Chaps, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Digitally speaking, I hasten to add. So we're here today to talk a bit about the election, and then we'll look ahead of the possibly inevitable horse race to the real meat for those who follow these things, which is the upcoming Tory leadership race and the future of conservatism.
Yeah, go on. That's a big topic.
So news this week has been we've had the party manifestos out. I think it would be fair to say I haven't read them all cover to cover. That's my confession. I'm not Stephen Bush. I'm fortunately spared these things, but I think it would be fair to say that they are thin and they all promise either not to raise taxes or in fact to cut them. And it's worth noting, of course, that the last 20 years have not been a period of taxes shrinking. So, you'll find, and the economy is now growing less than it was 20 years ago. So, how plausible you find that is probably dependent on how much you trust modern British politicians.
Yeah, for sure, because the problem that the parties have had is that in about 2007, growth just stopped, yeah. Right? And for most of the last 200 years, growth has more or less, with a few blips, just happened. Mm. And in the sort of democratic era, if you were Labour, then you got to say that was down to your sound, central stewardship and sharing the proceeds of growth. And if you were the Tories, you got to say it was because of your, sound economic management and letting the market do its thing. But broadly, like, some form of growth just happened. Mm. And the moment that ended, as far as I can see it, basically an entire political generation has just proven completely incapable of adapting to circumstances where that isn't the case anymore. Hmm. Because it used to be the case that you could sort of keep ramping up spending on the expectation that future growth would make would generate the tax receipts needed to pay for that. And in the absence of that growth, what we've seen is just all of our public spending commitments are ramping up, our population is aging, and they're consuming a larger and larger share of government budget and accounting for a larger and larger share of GDP with no way out, right? On the current trajectory, there's no reason for that doom loop to end. And then you plug those numbers into a sort of calculator and you run them 20 years into the future and the whole thing is very clearly unsustainable. But unlike in 1979 or even arguably in 2010, where there was some kind of public acceptance that things had to change, now we're in a completely different space. After COVID-19, the public want more spending and yet more, but there's nowhere to pay for it.
Fred?
I entirely agree with Henry's analysis on that one. It's a very, very difficult situation that neither major party has a really important, really convincing solution to. I mean, both are making large promises on house building, for example, which might well be one of the economic answers, ways out of this mess. But how plausible are they? I'm not sure if Labour's approach to new towns is really going to deliver, because it may well be they end up building, for political reasons, a couple of versions of Basildon, which was a new town which failed, rather than new towns like Stevenage, which succeeded. Then the Conservatives' pledges on 1.5 houses in the next parliament, 1.5 million houses in the next parliament, hardly seems plausible considering their record this parliament, and the fact that within our sort of unreformed planning system, basically the maximum we were able to squeeze out of it was about 250,000 new starts a year, and everything else beyond that turned into essentially political suicide. But the interesting thing is neither party seems to be wanting to pledge to move us away from the fundamentally discretionary planning system we have to a much more rules-based and therefore zoning for growth approach. Now, maybe Labour will go more aggressive on this than their manifesto suggests. They've got to take a risk-averse approach. Their manifesto, they're running the campaign of a front runner. And when you're running a campaign of a front runner, you do all you can to reduce attack surface. But getting bitten building seems to be their main theme. And to return to Henry's bigger point about the overarching demographic issues, planning reform, which also should involve a policy of pursuing the cheapest industrial energy we possibly can to compete with America. Those two policies are basically the only way we can discover the economic growth, which therefore pays to mitigate the demographic issues we have. Otherwise, the tax burden will have to go up, but it will have to go up to the point that it cannot go up. And arguably, the tax burden can't really increase that much more, because then it will grind out any remaining economic activity that we do have, and we'll see an exodus of talent and growth.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Labour's in a tricky position here, because of course they have to be able to sell some vision of economic growth. Stuff like building and development is one of the few levers they can plausibly claim to be pulling without massively scaling up government spending. Yet at the same time, if the Tories are terrified of reform eating into their right flank, Labour, if not terrified, is certainly concerned about, you know, the Liberals and the Greens and left-wing parties being able to chip into their support. And, you know, I'm based in Cambridge. You know, I know exactly what, you know, in local and national elections, what they're saying. And one of the huge parts of what they're saying is that the Labour are going to come and they're going to build on your beautiful green field. That's what the Greens are making hay out of that.
It's very true. Actually, worth remembering, the path to an election victory for Keir Starmer is always through Middle England. And it's always through it's through voters that like things that aren't really traditionally Labour. It was only a couple of days ago that Keir Starmer was saying Labour is now the party of drivers, which they've never said before, and they don't think they've ever felt compelled to say before. But it turned out that was one political area of advantage that the Conservative Party actually opened up over the Labour Party in the last couple of years, was stuff to do with policies around cars, LTNs, anything that affects the motorist. That was one of those things. So that's obviously a sign that Labour is going to have to do things to appeal to Tory-inclined voters to get into office. But then again, Tory-inclined voters have Tory inclinations, which run at odds for Labour's core vote. And it will be a very intriguing coalition of voters to manage, not unlike, I think, the way in which the Tory party had to manage a slightly heterogeneous coalition of voters since 2019. Now, I think the 2019 voting coalition had far more coherence to it than many do, but it's without a doubt undeniable that the party itself was incapable of working out how to bring those two people together.
My favourite one from the Labour manifesto today, and I'm a complete Bonapartist on infrastructure and house building, right? Like, and I will set out in a long delayed, but hopefully soon out, paper for the ASI, a way in which either party could be really ruthless about just building stuff where in the bits of the country they don't vote for it. But there's a wonderful bit in the Labour manifesto where it says that we're going to, quote, rewire Britain and get the national grid up to scratch for net zero. And it's like, that all sounds nice. But what that actually means is, assuming that they do build all of the necessary power stations, that industry estimates are that you'll need up to 460,000 kilometers of new onshore pylons to get the national grid ready for shifting cars and domestic heating onto electricity. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's easy to say we're going to rewire Britain, but there's a reason that people don't build those things, right? And that's because you end up with hysterical local residents talking about how they're in despair at this precious view that's going to be completely destroyed by this pylon. And, you know, in theory, if it was a fairly close election, you'd end up in a place where, like, Labour owned, like, held the cities and the Tories had all the countryside. Now, that's bad for housing because most of the housing needs to be in cities. But it would mean that Labour could just go absolute ham on railways, power lines, power stations, rural prisons, you know, just go round Tory seats and build stuff in them. But I think there's going to be potentially a real problem if Labour wins what people have started calling a supermajority. I've got no objection to it in principle. There's nothing unconstitutional about it. But it suddenly means you're going to have an awful lot of Labour MPs in exactly the kind of areas where Labour needs to be building this stuff.
Exactly.
And they're going to be complaining. And they're going to be saying that, you know, we need the right pylons in the right places. And they're going to be demanding endless consultations. And nothing, and yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Starmer will turn out to have more steel on this in office. But nothing I've seen from their manifesto really suggests that they grasp that the fundamental problem with when it comes to infrastructure and housing is not structural. Like the planning system is awful, but this is the United Kingdom. There are ways in which you can bulldoze through all of those objections. You can sign off planning proposals by ministerial decree, but no one's chosen to do it. And I don't see anything really in Labour so far that suggests that they're going to actually just bulldoze this stuff through local objections, which is ultimately the only way it will ever get built.
They've indicated interest in doing a couple of things like that, less so with housing, but more things they're now starting to deem of critical national importance or significance. Apparently importance and significance have different legal categories attached to them, and I can't remember which is which. But data centres have become a bit of a meme in Labour policy circles in the last couple of weeks, because we have seen multiple cases of local councils on the periphery of London refusing planning permission for data centres. Now, of course, without data centres, we basically can't have a tech industry. So data centres are absolutely vital. And it seems that like the Labour Party are suggesting we now create a sort of special class of planning permission for data centres specifically, which I think is maybe going about it the wrong way, because you're basically sort of picking a favoured thing and therefore designing rules around a favoured thing instead of making a more liberal rules-based system for all things, and therefore allowing the market to decide. But then that's my sort of free market here approach speaking, rather than the slightly more, you know, Labour approach, basically. But the interesting thing about this is that it puts a lot of faith in the planning process as decided by Whitehall rather than one decided by local councils. And it still remains to be seen whether the Labour Party would genuinely commit to preventing, you know, environmental objections to large pieces of infrastructure like data centers. Would they even limit the grounds for appeal, judicial review? Maybe when they're in government, they will have a change of heart and everything. But it does seem to me at the moment, bit of an outside chance that they will actually really properly deregulate the planning of these projects instead of, which I think would be most effective, instead of pursuing a favoured project industrial policy route.
Well, I mean, just one more thing to say, but I know you probably want to move on. But on this, you can do favour, you can just favour a lot of things as a way of bulldozing through the system. A development order under, I think, section 59 of the TC of the Town and Country Planning Act 1990 lets the minister basically either grant planning permission to a specific project or require local authorities to grant permission to any project that fits certain criteria. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, maybe just having one for data centers would be distortive, but if you can't get your MPs to sign off on a comprehensive national planning regime, doing dozens, hundreds of development orders is actually a perfectly practical way of doing it. But I agree with Fred about the regulation point. The last point I just want to make on this is last week, and I suppose, yeah, this might be a subject sort of close to the critic's heart, Labour were talking about beauty in architecture. And they went to Create Streets, and Create Streets did what they do best, and they produced some beautiful illustrations and mock-ups of sort of classic Edwardian style towns. And Angela Rayner was saying, yes, this is what Labour will build. And I sort of pointed out, and never got a response from Create Streets or anyone else, that like half the features that make those homes so attractive are illegal. You know, the windows were too big, the windows were too close to the ground, the windows opened too much, they had steps up to the front door, which means those buildings weren't wheelchair accessible, and so on and so on and so on. And it's like, we do need to have a dramatic winnowing and reconsideration of the building regulations to allow developers to build housing stock that people want, because it's absurd in any market for 100-year-old houses to command a premium over new build stock because they have loads of features that we've made illegal. But do you think that Labour is going to be the party that scales back on accessibility regulations, on fire safety regulations, on environmental and climate change regulations? I can't see it. I think Labour are too wedded to the things that have caused the problem to ultimately be able to deliver a sustainable solution.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about, I think we could happily do an entire podcast on the planning system and we'd all have a lot to say. But annoyingly, we still have an election to deal with. Yes. So I'm going to turn to another subject now, which is the Conservative ground game. So we've heard a lot. As we know, one of the reasons the Tory party has survived as long as it's had and being government as long as it's had is that it has always historically had the resources, and it's had a committed core of activists willing to go out and knock on doors for it. You know, that infrastructure is a big part of why the Conservatives are in government and reform is probably not going to be. But I think one thing that seems to be happening, and you know, Henry, you may be more expert on this than I, is that there seem to be fewer people willing to turn up for them this time around. And is it possible? You know, this is always, you know, it's always an older population, you know, Tory Party membership, but you know, and of course they don't reveal the figures. But are we perhaps seeing a disintegration of some of the infrastructure that's allowed them to keep coming back?
Well, this was always the case for having an election in May, right? Back when the Conservatives were talking about whether or not to have a quote-unquote early election. The case for it was to have one in May, so it coincided with the local elections. And the point of that was that, one, in large parts of England, the party would be out fighting for its own position, even the bits of it that weren't that enthused about Rishi Sunak. And at this point, there's no part of it that's enthused about Rishi Sunak. And you know, also, it would help bring under-motivated Conservative voters to the polls, right? Because there are still, even now, there is a category of voter who is a Conservative, who isn't switching to another party. And basically, their decision is whether they bother to vote or not. And a lot of people turn out to vote at a general who don't vote, who don't turn out to local elections, especially when they're sort of pissed off with the party that they support. So, and they didn't do that. And so we lost 500 councillors. And that means we lost probably several hundred people who are unwilling to now give up their summer to stump up for the party. And by extension, we've lost their friends and family. And it is a serious concern. It was actually, I can't remember where I picked this up, but it was put to me sometime earlier this year, that privately, whenever you get some policy wonk proposing a dramatic winnowing and streamlining of local government, the reason that both parties push back is that actually these days, local councillors are the party machine.
Yeah.
They are the people who turn up. They are the people who knock on doors. They are the people who do the canvassing. And if you were to, you know, if you were to get rid of the kind of slightly Ruritanian system of parish councils, borough councils, county councils, and all the rest of it, and you just wouldn't have enough people left to do the campaigning. And it's a serious, and so I agree with you, that is what's happening. And it is a serious problem, because we haven't really, in many ways, our party system is not ready for this kind of mass disengagement, right? You see it with the question of the Conservative leadership and Conservative internal democracy, right? Prior to 1998, a Conservative association could choose its own candidates, right, without a central list. They got rid of that.
Yeah.
So why do you, as in an age when people are less likely than ever to join things and be brand loyal, why do you join the Conservative Party? It's a question they haven't answered.
No, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I think it also sort of raises the question of, you know, we often, you know, we've got this was in the Labour manifesto, that they're promising to take money out of politics to get fewer MPs having second jobs. And I think to myself, I often think that there isn't enough money in British politics. I mean, you think the part of the problem is that there simply aren't the resources to sustain enough people in politics. I think a good example of this is that, you know, one of the only really big third party story in this election has been the rise of Reform, and Reform is more or less a private corporation with two men pumping money into it. It's yeah. not, you know, this is not a grassroots movement. And I'm not saying that as an anti-Reform point. I think Reform obviously is obviously tucking into a huge well of support and opinion that's completely unrepresented. But I don't think the British system is good at resourcing politics. So it's not like you can kind of build up a party and start getting local councillors and very easily scale up unless you've got lots of money coming in from outside.
Well, an interesting point. I think with the subject of Reform, at the moment, obviously, there is no grassroots operation to speak of, and they don't even have any of the legacy UKIP stuff, which by 2015, UKIP UKIP had built pretty successful grassroots infrastructure for what they were doing. I think even the Daily Express backed UKIP in 2015. So they managed to get pretty far reaches into beyond just the populist right fringe on the basis of their beginning out of a single issue campaigning group. And obviously it tapped into the disenchantment of the people on the right of the Conservative Party and that sort of fringe of politics. I'd be interested to know that if the scale of the potential defeat of the Conservative Party is so large that even part of the activist infrastructure would defect to reform. I'd be very interested to see what happens in future elections to the Welsh Assembly, because that's obviously an area where UKIP was very strong in Wales there, and also might tap into the sort of abolish the Senedd grassroots right-wing movement over there too. And there's which I think is worth considering. And I think actually to touch on Henry's point about the disengagement of the conservative activist base. Don't know how much emphasis to put on this, but when you have a conservative activist base who very, very much supported Boris Johnson's leadership of the Conservative Party and did also support Liz Truss's leadership of the Conservative Party against the will of MPs, you have to consider what are you bringing your troops along for when many of them think that the people leading them are not listening to their wishes. And the one constitutional role they do have left in the Conservative Party is choosing the leader. Then I think it's another example of trust breaking down between leadership and grassroots. It would be really interesting to see what happens after the general election, where the party decides to go on how the leadership election will run, how long it will run for, the role of the membership vote. We see a little bit of a campaign bumbling along over the last year or so to remove the members from the leadership vote end of the party leadership contest. I think William Hague has written about this a couple of times. He's written a Times column about even opposing the even concept of the local councillor turned MP, which I think he made a fair few interesting points about that with the demands of a national legislature. But it does mean that the Conservative Party needs to have a new look at who its voters actually are and where they are based. Are they concentrated or they're dispersed? At the moment, they are very dispersed, which in a first-past-the-post electoral system, if the party goes below a certain threshold, then they can be in real danger. Whereas a very concentrated electorate like Labour means that they have a higher floor than the Conservative Party. And therefore, considering the location of these voters and the buy-in, how do you build your activist base from it? I think these are going to be large questions which the party will have to wrestle with. And unfortunately, won't have that much time to wrestle with them, because presumably the future chairman of the 1922 committee will be elected and the rules for a leadership election will be established pretty soon after the general election.
Well, it's just interesting that you say that choosing the leader is a role that members still have, because I don't think that's an accurate framing. The leadership vote for Conservative members, there's an excellent article from John Strafford on Conservative Home about this, who was the campaign for Conservative Democracy that he founded. The vote on the leadership was given by William Hague as a sop to the membership when he completely disemboweled the Conservative Party's actual institutional democratic structure, because previously I think the pre-98 system in many ways made a lot more sense, right? In that the party was kind of structurally owned by the National Union of Conservative and Unionist Associations, so it was owned by the party as an institution. It was much less owned by the leader. Conservative associations essentially had independent freedom to choose who they sent to parliament. There was a glorious description of the Conservative Party in its heyday as 600 social clubs that dabble in politics. And then the leadership kind of had to work with what they got when they got there. But on the other hand, the actual candidacy for the premiership and for the leadership of the country was in the hands of the MPs, which I think ultimately is constitutionally essential. Our system's not as bad as Labour's because it does narrow it down to two, so that ideally both of them have like a necessary quorum of MP support. But I think this is the row I've had several times with kind of diehard Boris Johnson supporters, is that the Prime Minister fundamentally, constitutionally, needs to command the support of the House of Commons. And if you've got a Prime Minister who's suffered 50 resignations from his government, and it's not obvious that he can even populate a cabinet, the fact that he's been elected as leader in an internal Conservative Party process does not trump that constitutional reality. So I'd like to have a more democratic Conservative Party, but I think that the interesting thing about the 98 model is that it encouraged a kind of participatory membership, because you got stuff all the way down the line. You could join institutions and committees that mattered. You, as a member of an association, could literally just choose who you sent to Parliament. And people from all over the country, because this was before you just had a councillor pipeline, would come and audition. They'd come and audition for you to send them to Parliament. And I think that was a really good feeling. Whereas now, you get a vote on the leader once every few years, which, as Fred says, often doesn't pan out the way that you'd intended. And then national campaign headquarters sends you a short list of three at best for you to choose your MP from. So we've really diminished the status and the perks of being a Conservative Party member. And unsurprisingly, we have far fewer of them.
Entirely agree. I would like to see a return to something like the pre-1998 model. I'm sure there can be a way in which any party leadership is able to manage relationships with its associations sufficiently amicably and respectfully that an equivalent of an A-list without calling it an A-list is still able to operate and get some special favoured talents into Parliament without the sort of acrimonious breakdown in relations that we've seen over the last few weeks.
So now that we're on to the membership and the election, I want to turn to I think it's fair to say, barring a meteor strike, we're going to have a Labour government in a month. So I wonder, that also means we have an even happier occasion, a Tory leadership contest. So what are your predictions for that? Who do you think is likely to be the candidates involved? How many candidates are going to be left apart from anything else?
Who first?
I will have a go. I think that without staking too much here, there's obviously going to be such a material difference between a party of 150 MPs to 120 to 100 to 90 to potentially 60. So it's going to be very, very hard to work out who's left in the first place, because some of them are very, very prominent Conservative MPs right now on current polling might lose their seats. So you have a Penny Mordaunt in Portsmouth is very much on the line. Tory MPs with majorities of 15, 16,000 are incredibly threatened. So that already puts you into the sort of mega safe seat territory like Priti Patel or Kemi Badenoch, I think, whose boundaries get safer. I'm not sure what Robert Jenrick's boundaries do, but it's worth thinking about in that way. The MPs who've been clearly developing a bit of a more coherent policy platform with the nod to a leadership pitch, the front runners, in my view, seem to be Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick. Penny Mordaunt has obviously been doing a fair bit of soft kind of campaigning, but less on policy, more on, I think, sort of personality and positioning with the party. I still wouldn't be surprised if we see other MPs from the 2010 intake who are still around, a few sort of former secretaries of state, also put their hat in the ring on a sort of if not now when attitude. But then as well as potential people from the 2015 intake like Tom Tugendhat. I think that it could be a wide range of people seeking leadership. And the various options on the party will be quite interesting. I work on a general assumption that when final two MPs get put to the members, the more right wing of the two as defined will probably win. That is always on the front of the mind of the MPs when they go through their round after round after round of voting. We saw lots of chicanery on that front in 2022, where certain MPs were advanced with votes being lent and then taken away in order to make an easier path for a particular opposition. I'm not gonna state a claim right now, but I think the front runners that we will see out of the blocks quickest will be Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, and Penny Mordaunt.
Henry, your predictions.
Yeah, I think 2022 is interesting because it was actually because Rishi wasn't far enough ahead to play that game properly. I think it was the first Tory leadership election that I can remember where both of the final two candidates were the people that we were talking about as the final two candidates at the start of the race. Because normally what happens is that someone builds up sufficient support and then they just get their voters to their supporters to sort of lend votes to someone they think will be an easier opponent. But it didn't really happen. It did at the beginning. But it kind of petered out in 22, which was an early sign of trouble for Sunak. I broadly agree with Fred, I think, on who... It's always just trying to avoid your own biases here, because I think that the two most plausible, certainly, are Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch. I don't think either of them is a perfect candidate by any means. I think Kemi's biggest drawback is especially that she... And I respect this, she's an introvert who doesn't like journalists very much. And that's a completely understandable human sentiment. But when you are in opposition and you're having to fight for any media oxygen you can get, because, you know, you've just been smashed in an election and everyone wants to talk about what Labour is doing. And you might have Nigel Farage in Parliament using up even more airtime. I don't know if that's going to be helpful.
Yeah, but I saw some of those interviews with Paternock, and I don't know about you, but I have the strongest flashback to seeing, you know, Jeremy Corbyn on the doorstep with journalists. You could see you could sense the dislike. This is someone who didn't like being questioned, felt they. But already assuming the worst, already assuming they were getting misrepresented, defensive, you know, fists up, you know, it was exactly the kind of thing. And now maybe that's the sort of thing that will be fixed with a lot of media training. But I wonder if it's something more just basic about how they feel about the press. I don't know.
This is it. I think it is. I think it's genuinely, because it's not just about media training. Media training can do some stuff, although you can be overtrained. And I think actually one of Kemi's strengths is that she can be very authentically impressive when she wants to. You know, that line about the Equality Act as a shield, not a sword, that is the sort of thing that you get when someone has actually thought through their position on something. But it's you need to want it, right? You need to actually want to get up, go out, fight for airtime. You need to be endlessly pestering producers. You need to be coming up with lines. Like, it's exhausting. I think a lot of the party, especially MPs who've been elected since 2010, like, they actually just don't know what opposition is like. And opposition is hard. You, especially if you're used to having people paying attention to you by default because you're a Secretary of State, and you're used to having the entire civil service press operation helping to get your stories out, and you're used to having most of the parliamentary agenda under your control. Like, it's a very, very difficult job. And I think maybe from what I've seen, Jenrick, you might be more willing to go and hunt down those Labour bruises. But I think in some ways, it depends on how badly things go, because my first instinct is to say that this leadership election is not going to be the one that really matters, right? Because even if Rishi Sunak were to hang on for a few months to allow for a post-mortem, the Conservative Party has not got its diagnosis for Britain yet, right? There's a vast amount of intellectual work that has not been done. Mm. And until it's been done, you can't, to use a historical sort of analogy, you can't select your Thatcher until you've had your Keith Josephs and you've had your IEAs and ASIs doing all that work in the 70s to make that agenda there for someone like Thatcher to pick up. And that agenda doesn't exist yet. And if you look at the last time the Conservatives went into opposition, who were the people who eventually came in and really rebuilt the Conservative Party and sort of put their stamp on it, for better or worse? It was David Cameron, George Osborne, and people like Michael Gove, who were elected in 2001 and 2005. So my initial hunch would be, what really matters in this leadership contest is that this will be the leader who is selecting the class of 2029 and the class of 2033, the people who will be coming into the Conservative Party over the next 5 to 10 years. The only counterpoint to that, just quickly, is that actually I think our politics are hugely unstable. I think that this Labour majority is no more rock solid than was Boris Johnson's. And there is a chance, maybe in one parliament, but I think certainly in two, that Sir Keir Starmer becomes satanically unpopular. And no one thought in 2019, after the election, that Labour would be back with a big majority in one term. I think it's not impossible that the Conservatives could be back within two.
Well, I mean, and we'll get into the weeds on that, but I just wanted to, just on the leadership question, I had a couple of follow-ups for you both. So the first question is, we had a list of plausibles. I just want to add one more. Do you think Suella Braverman is a possible? So, I mean, she gave a very well-received speech at the last Tory party conference. A lot of people called it a leadership speech. Mm. But obviously she's very good and ill identified with the Rwanda policy. So do you think that's going to be, she's identified with the failures of the previous government, or do you think she can tell a story whereby, you know, she was beaten by the blob, by elements of the party, she's the one who can now take that policy forwards in exile?
I think it's a fair question. I think with the history of the Rwanda policy, it is worth remembering that it was actually Boris Johnson's policy when Priti Patel was Home Secretary, of course. And there, it was almost operational until a last minute ECHR ruling when there were people on the runway, I think. So the history of the Rwanda policy and its ownership is very interesting because it was actually developed way before then. And obviously it had been cooking before it was in public well earlier into Boris Johnson's premiership. But of course, Suella has run once before, and she had a respectable couple of rounds in the 2022 leadership campaign. And I wouldn't be surprised if there'd be a certain group of right-wing MPs and right-wing activists in particular that felt like actually that was the sort of pure right-wing choice that they might have, they should have otherwise backed, considering events since summer 2022. But ultimately, obviously, it depends on the makeup of the parliamentary party. But if we're going to assume that the left-to-right makeup of the parliamentary party is going to be roughly the same, I think that ultimately the MPs will coalesce against her before going to the membership, in a general sort of sense where there's all where the left and the right always kind of work out who is going to be the most dangerous threat on the other side of the party to them, and how can we orchestrate votes and lend votes and block them out. A typical call on the right of the party is always the left pick their nominee much more efficiently, much early on, and the right wing MPs always fight it out and then cancel each other out, leading to a much more successful left wing operation. Maybe that will happen again this time, but I do think for Suella Braverman's many sound approach, sound points on policy, sound beliefs on policy, this is going to be a more important issue facing her.
I mean, on Braverman, I think she and Patel have both been handicapped by the fact that they've been Home Secretary. And at this point, having a leader for who's been in the Home Office is a bit like having an English Pope. It didn't go well that one time, so we're probably not going to do it again.
Yeah.
She's basically the sort of voice of the id of the right wing of the Tory party. I found her intensely frustrating when she was Home Secretary, and I wrote a whole series of articles, which ended up being so frequent, I had to just refer to each of them and kind of acknowledge what I was doing, because she'll take sort of two or three good arguments individually, and then she'll lump them together inappropriately into a bad argument. And yep. She really, I think my biggest problem with Suella Braverman is that, one, I've not really seen much evidence that she really is prepared to get to grips with the mechanics of policy. Like any, like the Home Office is a bit of a special case, but like any MP who I see railing about the blob, I'm always deeply suspicious of. Like, you know, all of these processes that are apparently making it impossible to govern Britain, you're ministers of the crown, you could have changed them, no one has. I think sometimes the civil service just gets blamed for the fact that some of our ministers haven't been very good at running the country. But also, the only way that you get to do any of this stuff is if you get back into office. And I think a big part of the job of the Conservative Party, and especially of people in the Conservative Party who want to sustainably bring down immigration and get stuff built and so on, is putting in the hard work of finding ways to sell that agenda to not just reform voters, but to the voters who've left us for Labour and the Liberal Democrats, right? Like, you know, some of them will come back. I think there is a perfectly good, respectable case to be made for all kinds of policies that, you know, the right of the party would like in principle. But the problem that we have is that for some elements of the right wing of the Conservative Party, it vibes matter more than substance. What is the big task that we need for the right after this defeat? We need to come up with a diagnosis and for what's wrong with 21st century Britain, and a prescription, and one that brings together the different parts of the right. And I think actually there is one here. And you look at why this has happened in the public sector, which is that budgets are stretched, tax receipts are flat, the economy is flat. Actually, growth is the answer. Because if a government went really big on infrastructure and other pro-growth policies, that would create the tax receipts that would allow public sector pay to rise. And allowing public sector pay to rise would allow us to recruit domestically and wean the public sector off a dependence on imported labour. Mm. Now, that would require a future Conservative government having these tax receipts and choosing to spend them on higher public sector wages rather than tax cuts. And that will be a bridge to cross when we come to it. But I think there is a way through here in which the kind of Britain remade, let's get Britain building, and the overwhelming concern on the right about the fact that we're importing 500,000 people a year, there's a synergy. There is a solution to both. And the one actually gives us the tools to solve the other.
I totally agree. I feel like there is a pro-growth national conservatism agenda waiting to be grasped in Britain, and it's something we should certainly pursue.
Yes, I mean, my follow-up question for this is that might be desirable. How likely is that to happen in the contemporary Conservative Party, even in the wake of a historic defeat?
Over what time frame?
Yes. That's a good question. I mean, that's a fair question. Let's say the next 5 years.
I mean, I think the problem with the next 5 years is that it depends how quickly things get really bad for Labour. And I don't say this as a partisan point. Labour are just coming into office with one of the worst set of conditions that we've had in modern times and a load of structural problems that aren't going away. And I do think that if things go too wrong for them too quickly, that there is a chance that the party will retreat into its comfort zone, and it will have the whole we just need to pull together, we just need to keep prioritizing party unity, which is an absolutely fatal mistake, which has got Rishi Sunak where he is today. You need generational change. I think it's fascinating to me talking to people in the Conservative Party, and you talk to people of my age and Fred's age, who are by no means, I can't speak for Fred, but for myself, I'm by no means a young man, except in this country's warped economy. And you look at the think tanks, and you look at what the think tanks are producing, and you look at the Conservative Manifesto, not the headline policies, which were boomer focused, but like they needed to fill at least two pages of A4 with quite small text. And so quite clearly, they just handed large parts of it off to people who knew what they were talking about. And so the like page two of an awful lot of the Conservative Manifesto on each policy area is quite good. And it's full of like stuff from Britain Remade. It's full of stuff on children, on stuff on building, and all kinds of other things. But then I talk to a Cameron-era SPAD, even a senior one, and it's not so much that we should be in different parties. It's almost as if we live on different planets. We have completely different understandings of the economy, of the proper functioning of government. One of them, when I mentioned, that I think people having children is going to be a policy issue in the next 10 years, called me a crank because you can, quote, just import people. It's extraordinary. And so it will take a while for that to feed through, if it does. And I think, the big problem is, as William Hague rightly said, if the Conservative Party just keeps picking councillors, and councillors keep bringing that local mindset to Parliament, that's going to be a real problem. But on the right, outside of the parliamentary Conservative Party, I think that we're not there yet. We haven't got a completely worked out program. And inevitably in the immediate aftermath of the election, the NatCons are going to be denouncing the Libertarians, and the Libertarians are going to be denouncing the One Nationers and all the rest of it, because that's what you do. But I think that we have got the foundations of a really good agenda. The question is, who can do the work of selling that into the Conservative Party? And that's not guaranteed. We need to have our equivalent of, and I'm not saying with the same agenda, but I'm saying in terms of the historic role they played, we need to have our equivalent of the IEA. We need to have our equivalent of Keith Joseph. We need to have people who do the intellectual work and can then sell it to the Conservative Party. Because in the next 5 years, we can't expect the Conservative Party to pick up a ball that doesn't exist yet.
Well, wrap things up with a final question for you both. So we've talked about the future of the Tory party. There's one elephant in the room, which is reform. Now, reform is currently nipping at the heels of the Conservative Party in the polls. That won't translate into seats, at least not very many. But is this going to be a long-term problem for them? Is it that, as in previous periods, it will surge, it will then recede as soon as the election disappears, and the Tories will still be there with their infrastructure ready to be the real party? Or is reform going to latch its jaws around the throat of the Conservative Party and not let go? Is Farage going to get into Parliament and just be a visible face for the movement and be a continual problem for the right?
So I think that It's more likely to be the latter than the former. I think the advantage that the Conservative Party had over UKIP previously wasn't just because of the delivering the referendum results and then leaving the European Union, but it kind of speaks to Henry's earlier point about just the difficulty of being in opposition compared to the ability of being in government when you literally can set the narrative and have all the infrastructure with you. When the Conservative Party has zero ability to set the policy agenda of the country from position of opposition, it makes Farage's position comparatively much stronger, even if he is a one-man band in Parliament, or perhaps the leader of maybe three MPs. And with the sort of moral legitimacy which comes with polling potentially very close to the Conservative Party, I think I've seen four opinion polls which put Reform in the sort of 15 to 18, 15 to 17 territory now. That lends him a political legitimacy to talk about the future, the state of the British right and the future of the right. I also think that that could lead to obviously greater financing for this party. Be very interesting what happens in local elections and this party, this discussion of party infrastructure as well. And it will definitely shape the state of the immediate Tory leadership election, or potentially a future one too, depending on how things work out. And also who ends up becoming more capable of criticising the state of the Labour government and what it's going to do.
I agree. I think Farage getting into Parliament would substantially change it, because as it is, Reform is entirely dependent on the air war, right? Yeah. It doesn't have a ground machine. Even the activists it has, this is a problem that UKIP had. They're good at leafleting, but they don't like knocking on doors. They don't have that kind of granular ground war infrastructure. And so there was always a danger for them that after the election, when they weren't interesting, and when Labour was using all the headlines, and you know, the press have to go to one right-wing party to get a critical end quote. And which one is it going to be, the one with 100 MPs or the one with one, right? Or the one with none. But if Farage is in there, well, one, he has a platform and he's good media clicks, so people will report him. Two, he'll get short money, which will make up for the huge problem that the sort of Farageist parties have had since they lost the EU Parliament gravy train, which was essential to their operation. And three, and I think this might be the most important one, he'll have unrestricted access to Tory MPs in the tea room. He's never had that before. You know, yeah. You might occasionally have, he'd have had coffee or lunch, well, not coffee, but, you know, five beers or a proper lunch or whatever it was. But in Parliament, he'd be able to talk to them all the time in a way that the whips couldn't really control. And that would be very interesting. I think the biggest problem, though, is that Reform doesn't have anything resembling a proper pitch, right? Like, it was interesting watching Farage go to places the Conservative Party probably should go but doesn't in his launch, like when he explicitly linked immigration to the cost of living crisis and the housing crisis,
yeah,
which is exactly the kind of thing the Conservatives can't do because they've tripled net immigration and they don't really want to build any houses. But you know, do Reform UK voters actually want to concrete over the Greenbelt? Do they actually want to build nuclear power plants? Do they actually want to do any of the kind of hard work? I don't think they do. I think, you know, Reform UK voters are for voters who are justly angry at the Conservatives for failing to deliver on their promises. But Nigel Farage has never had to deliver on a promise in his political life. And so I think that at the moment, any shadow he casts is probably going to be a counterproductive drag towards magical thinking. But I wouldn't overestimate talk of a merger, right? Like, we are now talking about Canada 93, which is the famous election where the Canadian Conservatives went to two seats. But in that election, Reform Canada entered Parliament with 50 seats. And even then, a merger took 10 years and two more general elections in which the Conservatives came fifth. Right. That's how long that took for the Conservative Party to decide to merge with Canadian Alliance, as it became. So I really don't think that even if the Conservatives got 100 seats, which would be an abject result, and Reform get their three, I really don't think that there will be a merger on the cards anytime soon. Not least because, unless you're Suella Braverman, any Tory leader has to know that it is not in their interest to let Nigel Farage into the party because he wants their job. And a lot of members would probably give him their job. Right? For the same reason that none of them were going to reselect Boris Johnson to be a candidate in this election.
Well, on that happy Farage doubting note, Fred, Henry, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure as
thank
always.
You. It's been a delight. Bye-bye.
Au revoir.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.